when you're getting up at 3 a.m. and you're 21 and all your friends are like, should we go for drinks after work? And you're like, well, no, because I've got to drive an hour and a half and get up at 3 a.m. mm-hmm. to get to my early shift.
That's mad.
In minus 18 degrees. Yeah. And I was the only female in the entire depot. I got there on day one. It's a very resilience building experience. Yeah.
Welcome to another episode of What My Best Friend Does, where we talk about what your best friends do so you don't have to. Today, I'm talking to my best friend, the VP of Commercial Sales, Beth. Beth, how are you doing?
Very well. How are you?
I'm doing very, very well. Thank you. Good. Welcome to the show. Good to have you on.
Very excited to be here.
Lovely. We like to start with a little icebreaker on the podcast. What did you want to be growing up?
What did I want to be growing up? I think if my mum was here, she would say the boss.
Okay.
And I hadn't defined exactly what the boss of I wanted to be, but that has been my character since I was a child.
Okay.
I never wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to be a head teacher. I didn't quite understand why I had to be a teacher first.
Okay.
And that was the story throughout my kind of whole.
So you wanted to hold some level of like authority?
I think so. I think that was... that was what I always saw those positions and thought, that's
okay,
exciting and challenging and I'm interested
in. Okay, I love that. So you had a dream to be the boss. I mean, you're a VP now, which sounds pretty bossy. On that, can you talk us through your journey to this point, starting from, like education and then, into your roles of employment?
So should I start at university?
Yeah.
Best start. So I studied law.
Okay.
Wanted to be a solicitor. I think when you're at school, especially if you have this I want to be a boss mentality, which is so childish, but here we are. You're like, oh, what are like the best jobs? And really at that time, the most competitive thing to get into is like being a doctor or a lawyer.
Okay.
So I was like, I am not good enough to be a doctor. I don't have the patience. I don't have the brains. So okay. I was like, okay, I'll be a lawyer instead.
Okay.
So I studied law, loved my law degree, loved all of the theory. Very hard, was humbling. I'm dyslexic as well. So writing that amount of essays and doing that amount of reading was like insane for me. Mm. But really enjoyed it. And then I left and I tried to apply to loads of training contracts, got rejected by every single one. And then I was like, obviously in a state where I was like, this is everything I wanted to do. Everyone was getting training contracts around me. For those who don't know, a training contract is what you need to qualify to be a lawyer. So you do a law degree, then you do a training contract.
And they're typically like 2 years, aren't they?
Typically two years, and you have to apply to law firms and they have to agree to kind of sponsor you and put you through that qualification. So I didn't get any of those. So I was kind of at a crossroad. So I thought, okay, like this isn't working. I was having like a bad experience with the interviews as well. They weren't enjoyable for me.
Yeah.
So I applied for the Sainsbury's graduate scheme. I was incredibly lucky to have applied for one grad scheme that wasn't a training contract. I got all the way through to the final interviews and they only took 20 people. So it was an incredibly competitive grad scheme.
Wow.
And it was a bit of an afterthought for me to do it, which is crazy. Now I think you think back, because at the time I was like, yeah, fine. Like I'll do it until I become a lawyer.
Yeah.
I didn't actually realize that like this was a very, very fortunate
prestigious
good position,
yeah.
And a good grad scheme, amazing kind of big brand to have on your CV, big name in the UK. So
what happens, is there like a Do Sainsbury's have many different grad schemes, or is it just the one?
They have one grad scheme. Well, when I was there, they were talking 10 years ago, okay. Without showing my age. I'm sure these lights are doing that for me.
No, you look good. You look good.
So they had one grad scheme at the time, 20 people, but there was four different schemes within that 20 people.
Okay.
So like five did buying, five did supply chain and logistics, five I think did like store leadership. So in the stores, and I think there was another five that was doing, I think it was tech at the time. So okay. Like data and analysis.
And then is it 6 month rotation on each of the four?
So no, you were just in one for 2 years.
You're just in one
so
for
you
two
were kind
years.
Of, but you did 6 month rotations within your specialization.
So which was your specialization?
I did supply chain logistics.
That sounds sick.
It was an amazing experience.
She says, okay, and really? Okay.
Well, picture me. I'm like, think I want to be this high-flying solicitor. And then on day one in your grad scheme, they're like, okay, so like everybody's going to spend 6 months in the store.
No.
Day one. So you're there. There's a head office in Holborn, central London. I've moved to London. I think like this is it. I've made it.
Yeah.
I've got all my suits. I'm done that out of uni. I'm gassed.
Ready to be
the
boss.
I'm ready to be the boss.
Yeah.
And then I spend 6 months over Christmas.
No.
Genuinely stocking turkeys. I slipped a disc in my back because I was there on Christmas Eve, just like restocking emergency turkeys and packing them. And it was insane. And honestly, the amount of respect I have for retail workers is ridiculous.
But do you know what? I think it's good that they make you do that because then it gives you perspective on, I suppose, changes or proposals that you want to do that are going to impact your fellow employees, right?
Massively.
Okay, so you did that for 6 months.
Like, and I had to go in and we were given like leadership positions in the store. So you were this like 21-year-old nobody who knew nothing, kind of coming into people's worlds who had been in the stores for years and were like amazing at what they did. And then you were trying to manage them. It was a very strange, but a very good experience. At the time, did I enjoy every single day? No. But like now I look back and think that was the most amazing experience. And the people I met, I was never going to meet in like the head office in Sainsbury's.
Yeah.
And they're amazing people. 100%. So it was a really good experience.
So you did that for 6 months and then...
I thought I was going into the head office.
Okay. The plot thickens.
The plot thickens. I got sent to a frozen depot.
What?
In Elstree for 6 months.
Oh my God.
I did shift work from 6 a.m. to 2 a.m. And then...
6 a.m. to 2...
Oh, sorry, 6 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Okay.
And then the day shift was 1 p.m. to 8. And then I did night shift as well.
Oh my God. And what happened at the depot?
And it was minus 18 degrees.
And what was the objective of this? So you've done the in-store experience. What was the...
This was to learn about how the food gets from supplier all the way to the store.
Which again, actually sounds pretty logical.
It does. In hindsight,
yeah.
You go, wow, I know so much more than most people know about this supply chain, yeah. Right? When you're getting up at 3 a.m. and you're 21 and all your friends are like, should we go for drinks after work? And you're like, well, no, because I've got to drive an hour and a half and get up at 3 a.m. Mm-hmm. to get to my early shift.
That's mad.
In minus 18 degrees. Yeah. And I was the only female in the entire depot. I got there on day one. It's a very resilience building experience. Yeah. I got there on day one.
Nobody said being a boss was easy.
No. Very humbling.
Yeah.
Got there on day one and they said to me, don't worry, we've put a lock on the outside of the female loo so that only you can get in.
Oh my goodness.
And I was like young, 21, going, I don't quite understand. And then I kind of got it and I was like, right. Yeah. Okay. And then, so I was just there with like 50 other men that worked on the shifts.
Okay. Did you meet great people there?
I did meet great people there. And a while, they warmed up to me because they too were like, who are you?
And you're like managing them again.
Correct.
Yeah.
So I'm managing a shift of 40 men who are like well seasoned. They work in minus 18 degrees. I don't think you quite understand what that must feel like. What type of person you have to be able to do that
on a regular,
just lugging massive mounds of ice and like frozen and boxes just like all day every day. So I'm coming in going like, hi guys, I'm Beth, and they're literally just looking at me like, what are you doing here? And do you know what, it was so fair enough.
Yeah.
Like, it was so fair enough. So I learned so much. I mean, they learned nothing from me. They learned nothing from me.
But you learned a lot from
me. I learned a lot from them.
Okay, so we're a year in and we've not touched head office. Now what?
Then I came to head office.
Okay.
It's really boring.
I knew you were going to say that. It was really warm and cozy.
It was warm. And I was like, God, this is so easy. It was easy. I got there at 9. Everyone, like, got bagels from the staff canteen.
Yeah.
And I was like, we're not going to go, like, into some, like, frozen depth. Yeah. Are we not going to clean up the aisles? Yeah. Like, what are we doing? So I was a supply chain analyst there.
Okay.
So that was my last bit. So that was kind of all about forecasting how much you would need in the stores, but for obviously the whole of the UK.
Yeah.
So it was a lot about dealing with data, working out like individual regions' needs, understanding kind of seasonality of products, how to manage waste. And I worked in the meal solutions team. So that was like the meal deal. So everyone who knows about the meal deal, if you get that wrong, and back then pre-COVID and people didn't have their lunch, you had Twitter, everyone on you.
What would be your meal deal choice?
Such a good question. I have analyzed so many meal deals, you won't even believe. I would say, do you know what? It's such a risk that you get a dry sandwich that this could be a bit rogue. But I often go for like a tuna sweet corn because
it's not dry.
It's not dry.
Okay.
That is genuinely why.
Snack
or Walker's Salt Vinegar Squares.
Okay. And drink.
On a treat, I'd get a peach iced tea.
Okay.
But every other day, a Coke Zero. Lipton's.
Okay. Yeah. All right, I'm going to say mine. This is what I asked you. Prawn mayo sandwich.
Stunning.
Love it. Max paprika crisps. Sensational. And then what I get at the moment, it's like a protein shake.
It's good value for money.
It's for goodness shakes. That's what they're called.
For goodness
shakes.
What flavor?
Strawberry.
Yeah.
If it's there. If not, you know, got to sell with the chocolate, but beggars can't be choosers. Maybe a naked if I'm feeling fresh, you know, get the green naked. But okay, we're there. My first question is, obviously, you've studied to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
You've obviously had the setback.
Yeah.
You've now been in this grad scheme. Has what you've done in your degree transferred to anything that you've done in this time?
I would actually probably say the main thing that transferred was being resilient to things that you didn't feel like you could do.
Yeah.
I think I found my law degree really hard and I had to like work a lot harder than some people who were really good at kind of English and writing, and that didn't come naturally to me at all. Like, I'm actually more of like a math science brain. Don't ask me why I did law when I studied chemistry for A-level. So I think I was quite used to that. So then when I kind of went into these environments where I genuinely, obviously had never worked a day in my life in a store and I was having to manage these people, and then obviously went into a depot and then became an analyst, I think instead of just being like, I'm not going to do this, I'm quitting, like, this is not what I signed up for, I was just like,
roll your sleeves up.
Just be nice to everybody, be humble. You don't know what you don't know. So like, just try and learn and just like make the experience work for you.
Okay. And another question that comes to mind. So we mentioned the fact that only 20 people get on this grad scheme. Mm-hmm. To any listeners who are potentially like applying to grad schemes and stuff at the moment, I know you said, you were lucky. Is there any advice you could give to people who are, you know, putting in applications, for a grad scheme to help set them apart?
What I would say is if your chosen field is a real, definitely a learning from me, isn't letting you in, like the doors don't seem to be opening, and I don't know what's missing on your experience or your CV, I would set your cast quite wide. Because you apply for a grad scheme at the age of 21 and you do it for 2 years does not mean that's your career. Your career is what, 60,
Unfortunately.
We all hope not, but it's all, as I say, 60 years long. Yeah. These 2 years that you're going to do is not going to define what you're going to be doing when you're 60 years later. So I would just say cast a wide net. Apply for things that you didn't think you might not be interested in, but if they're a well-known brand or they have budget to support a grad scheme, you're going to learn something. And even if it isn't what you want to do long-term, so for Sainsbury's, I left after my grad scheme straight away because I knew that actually like the culture of Sainsbury's, the job role wasn't exciting. It wasn't challenging for me. That stepping stone was like, I will forever be thankful for. Like that is the reason that Amazon employed me.
And that takes us nicely into what you did next.
Yes.
Amazon.
Jeff B.
The Everything Store.
Yes.
Yeah. Talk us through, what you did whilst you were at Amazon.
So I was there for 6 years.
That's a long time.
It's a long time to be in Amazon. Anyone who works at Amazon will be here like, oh yeah. My God, I can't believe you were there for 6 years. I think it's you either love it or you survive.
Okay. All right.
I loved it.
Okay. I'm glad to hear that.
And that's probably why I stayed for so long.
And did you stay in like supply chain knee type roles?
No.
Okay.
I immediately moved to an e-commerce kind of buying brand facing role. Okay. So my job was working with kind of like the biggest cookware brands at the time. So I was working with like Le Creuset, Brita, some big names, like Tefal, these types of people. And I was helping them grow their account on the Amazon platform in the UK. So really different to what I was doing, but was able to transfer a lot of like the skills that I learned as an analyst, a lot of like what I learned about like retail and consumer habits in Sainsbury's. But then I had like the biggest learning curve to understand e-commerce, which is not the same as offline retail, like has no similarities at all, which was awesome, but it was hard, I would say. Amazon learning curve is steep, and the culture and the ways of working and how they communicate, and
it's just steep. It's just intense. Yeah.
It's intense, and everyone there is a genius. Okay. Everybody.
So it's like, it's not for everyone.
No.
And I think that's something to consider before you apply to a job at a company like Amazon. Would you say when you were there, you had a good work-life balance?
Depending on the role.
Okay.
And depending on what was going on, there were certainly times in my career there, especially over COVID, when I was in a team where we were launching the new Amazon Fresh stores.
Yeah.
So that was a secret at the time. It had only been launched in the US. There was like a secret squad team. There were 7 of us at the time.
Wow.
That were based in the UK, and we were responsible for launching and basically mapping out the strategy for UK and Europe launch, which would be very different to the US because the consumer and the retail environment completely different. Mm. Which was an amazing project to be on, but it was an insane place to be. Especially over COVID, because we had a strategy and then we had to change everything based on COVID changing everything. The supply chains had changed. We were building stores in secret. Building works got held up. My job just became whatever was required I was doing.
But what a learning experience that must have been, right?
It was amazing.
You must have been put in so many situations because you're basically a startup within... a behemoth of a company like Amazon. It must have given you great exposure to the rest of the business, right? So talking about Amazon Fresh, how long were you there? Or that Amazon Fresh project? How long did that last?
Amazon Fresh project, probably 3 years in total.
Wow.
And the first year and a half was pre-launch.
Okay.
Secret.
Yeah.
So like I couldn't tell like family members what I was doing. Nobody else in Amazon knew what we were doing. I mean, look, these are best kept secrets, right? Everyone was a bit like, what's going on? So we had like our own like locked room within the Amazon head office. Like they take this stuff very, very seriously. And as you can imagine, we were like fighting for retail space. So we were fighting with like Tesco, Sainsbury's. So we had to be like so on the lockdown because if they found that we were trying to like launch stores, they would take over the retail space just to block our launch. So it was like a real interesting experience.
And in terms of like the fresh store, so I used to visit them frequently, not so much now because there isn't one right next to my house. Don't kill me. Are you coming up with like the design layout? Was it always a decision that there was never going to be like cashiers and stuff, and that you were always going to like, is this stuff that you conceptualized in that year and a half, or was there like, this is what, you know, Jeff wants the stores to be like, or were you given autonomy to decide what that experience was like?
So I would say the only thing that we didn't have autonomy on, this was quite rare for Amazon. So Amazon, again, one to think about when you're applying. Most teams, the US is like obviously the head office. And then the US kind of say, you go and do what we've done, but do it in the UK. So you don't have all the autonomy in the world. Whereas in this project, they basically said to us, do not do what we've done in the US.
Okay.
For loads of different reasons. They knew that the whole market, if anyone's been to the US and been to a supermarket in the US and how big they are and just how completely different they are to like a Tesco, they don't even have any own brand products out there. So we're also used to buying like Tesco own chicken. Like you don't get branded chicken in the UK.
Yeah.
You do in the US. Yeah. So they kind of said to us, don't do what we do, but you must use checkoutless stores.
Okay.
So the technology we basically got given, which was, I mean, awesome technology. The rest we had to design, every single thing was up for question. Like what tier do we want to be? Who's our competitors? How big are our stores? What's the layout? What's the portfolio of food we want to supply?
How many stores in total did you end up launching?
When I was there, I think we hit number 10.
Okay.
And then I left.
Oh, wow. Okay. And that
we did 10 in like 1 year. It was a lot.
Okay. That's sick. And like I said, I went into the stores and it was really cool knowing that you played a part in, you know, bringing those stores to life. I mean, I've been to, yeah, the one in Angel and the one near Tower Bridge. I've forgotten the name of the road. Don't kill me. But yeah, it was just, it was really cool to know that you played a major role in that. You mentioned that you know, you remained there for a year, you moved on. Where did your career take you next?
This is when I joined Heroes, where I am now.
Okay.
So it's almost 2 years ago now. Yeah. So I joined as commercial director. So Heroes is an aggregator of baby brands.
Okay.
So basically what we do is we acquire existing baby brands in the market. So a good example is Trunky. We recently acquired this year. And our whole model is that we kind of acquire in the same kind of industry, mm-hmm. kind of bring the synergies together, let the brands like be their own independent, unique brand for the customers. We don't try and like, we don't try and phase the brands.
Meddle.
We don't try to meddle.
Okay.
The Trunky consumer is the Trunky consumer. And we bought the brand wanting to make sure that we really protected that consumer and protected that brand. But what we do is that we use kind of all of like our central teams and synergies to support all the brands that we've bought.
So like, yeah, basically what you do, and you know, hopefully I'm not butchering this, you benefit from economies of scale, right?
Correct.
Because you can utilize your supply chain to supply to all of the different brands, yes. and save money there.
Yeah.
Increasing profits, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
You want to give me a job? No, that's all right. Okay, so that is what Heroes does. Completely
yes.
makes sense. What, talk me through the role of commercial director. What is your day-to-day like?
What's my day-to-day like? A lot of meetings.
Okay.
So if I had to think about my day, I probably have a minimum of 6 to 7 hours
of meetings.
Which is insane.
Yeah.
But my role is largely trying to, as you can imagine, we have so many different brands. We have actually 30 brands now. Obviously some are a lot smaller, some are a lot bigger, but every single one almost have like their own team. They have their own strategy. They have their own needs. My role is basically to work across all of these to understand kind of where are the synergies, where are the cost savings, how can we support, how can we utilize the supply chain of the brand that we bought in the US to be able to launch the Trunky now in the US.
Understood.
So a lot of that is talking to different stakeholders, talking to supply chain, talking to our logistics, suppliers, compliance, our legal team, and then also trying to advise the teams on how best to go about, say, launching products in the US or how to consolidate supplier bases. Now, obviously, I don't do that all on my own, but that is the conversations we're having on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, and I'm putting you on the spot here. You've obviously started as commercial director. You're now VP of commercial sales. How do the roles differ?
I think the scope is just
bigger.
Bigger. By nature of the company, we are growing exponentially because we buy a lot of businesses. So when I joined, I think we were on about 50 million annual revenue. We're now way over $113 million.
Wow.
And that's happened in 18 months. So if you imagine when I joined versus now, my job, nobody else has joined to do my job, and my job has just gone
bigger. Wow.
Bigger. So that is an element, but also we've also launched new sales channels. So we used to be, when I joined, very, very Amazon focused, hence my background, where about 90% of our sales were Amazon. Now actually only 50% are Amazon. So we now do a lot of I'm back into my retail days of working in wholesale, working with stores like John Lewis, Target, Walmart. And we also have like D2C websites as well. So it's got more complex.
It sounds like the job you have now is a culmination of all of the like previous roles you've held, because when I hear you talk about you know, the synergies between, you know, stock and where you can launch things, it sounds like all of a sudden those cold rainy days when you worked at Sainsbury's have really played a part and allowed you to I suppose have better conversations with the suppliers and stakeholders you deal with now.
100%. I mean, I'm a commercial director, so my whole job is to, like, as well as meetings, look at numbers, evaluate our performance, question trends, understand why we're doing what we're doing. That's my whole job. And I'm so profit and loss focused, right? Yeah. That's my job. However, to be able to generate the sales that we do, you have to have the product in the right place for the customer. So that means supply chain logistics is just absolutely critical. And I think because I spent time in my career having experience in that too, when I speak to kind of like my VP of supply chain, VP of sourcing, I have a level of understanding. So we can have a conversation and I can even question some decisions because I'm not coming from like zero knowledge.
Understood.
And like that makes my life just like 10 times easier. And I assume theirs, because they're not talking to someone who's just there like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
They don't have to baby me so much. Yeah. I mean, to be clear, if they were here, they'd be like, Beth doesn't know that much. And
yeah,
she doesn't.
Okay.
They teach me a lot. But there's like a level of understanding.
Understood. The final thing I want to ask in this section. So obviously you're very numbers focused. Do you want to maximize profitability? You've spoken about the fact that you're acquiring all these brands. Are you also in charge of making the decision on which brand you go ahead and acquire, or is that decision, does that lay elsewhere?
Yes, no, thankfully that is not part of my remit as well.
Okay.
But I am involved in the process. So we have an M&A team, a merger and acquisition team, and their whole role is basically trying to find opportunities in the market, speaking to these kind of like founders of these businesses. Are they open to a sale? Some of these negotiations can take years. Some of them can take 3 months. Some of them are so quick. So it's really different. And those guys are like out in the market trying to work that out. Okay. I think once it gets to a certain stage of the deal, then they would loop me in and they would loop the supply chain VP in, and they would say, guys, like, this is the nature of the business. This is the numbers. This is what we can see. This is the analysis. What are your views? Like, would you be happy to run this company? Because the reality is what they buy is going to come into my world the next day. So I need to make sure that we obviously have to work together, because they can close a deal and that's like, well done them, and they can go and celebrate. But then I need to go and run that company. And then that's when it becomes obviously quite challenging.
And on that note, obviously with more companies coming on board, you know, I've been part of an acquisition. So
been acquired?
A company who I worked for, not me.
Oh, okay.
I wish. But my previous employer, our company was acquired. Okay, and, yeah. You know, everybody went along to the new company. Everyone made a little bit of money. But yeah, there's like new management, new this, new that. So I know that, you know, when you are acquired into a new company, there are all these questions. My question to you is, how do you navigate those conversations, and who are the main stakeholders that you're dealing with as a commercial director?
This is probably, it's a very common and a complex thing to navigate.
Because people are worried, right, about their jobs, about whatever.
People are the most complex part of any business. Yeah. Because numbers on an Excel sheet I can work with. Yeah. Yeah. People are different. Like every number is the same. Mm-hmm. Every person is completely different. Yeah. So I think that's probably our, like, it's our biggest challenge as a company, but it's also very much the biggest opportunity that we have, because as soon as you acquire a company, especially if that company comes with people, which for the last kind of four acquisitions we've done has, and we wanted to acquire those people because they come with all the knowledge of the brand. We absolutely wouldn't have acquired it without them, because we are not the experts. Mm-hmm. And you'd lose that overnight. Mm-hmm. When we acquire them, I think Heroes does a really amazing job of being really hands-on. We're not like a private equity company where we kind of acquire you and then we're like this weird big brother in the background, and everyone on the ground is a bit like, who is this company that's bought us? Like, and loads of unknowns. We always try and make an effort on like week one of acquisition to fly out to wherever it is, or travel if it's in the UK, and the founders all come and they try and like spend a lot of time with the people in the offices, reassuring everybody. When our model is not to go in and just kind of like look at everyone's job. And as I said, we try and keep brands standalone. So we very much come in and say, hey, we're Heroes. How can we help you? Not what can you give us? It's like quite a different approach. And I think we've been really successful with that approach, because more brands are thinking, oh, like actually I would quite like to be bought by that company, because they're like, they're different. And actually maybe my brand can go from like where it is today to this huge global success.
Because you're
independently, they can't do that, right? It's really hard.
It's all about distribution, isn't it?
It is.
It's why I like Mr. Beast. That's like why Feastables is so, it's so popular, and like Prime, because they're so well known, they've got like the hookups with their suppliers. And so yeah, it's a distribution game. I see you, Heroes.
It's a distribution game.
I see what you lot are doing. I know it. I understand it. So yeah, just following up from that. So obviously you go in, you speak to people. You mentioned like the VP of supply chain. As a commercial director, who would you say the main stakeholders you deal with are? Does it vary? You've mentioned VP of supply chain, so I'm just thinking anyone else along those lines?
So supply chain, marketing, and sourcing, I would say are like the main three. Like that is kind of...
the main stakeholders.
Yeah, main stakeholders, like the holy grail. Those three work together. You have to market the products. Customers need to know them. They need to look good content. Absolutely critical, especially like to consumer research. Supply chain, you need to get the products in the right place for customers to be able to buy them. And then sourcing, you've got to actually source the right products and launch new ones. So they're probably the holy grail. But outside of that, my main stakeholders are obviously the co-founders. So they're three brothers. So I work super closely with them, obviously.
I wanted to make a joke. Like, are they like Batman, Robin, and Alfred? Because the company's called Heroes.
Got it. No, they're like neither of those.
Don't kill me.
No. And Alfred. Okay, yeah. I'd love to see one of the brothers. Which one's Alfred?
Yeah. No, that's Pete.
Which one's Robin? I don't even know who you'd want to be, to be honest. Everyone wants to be Batman. Yeah. All three of them are Batman. Okay, there good. We go. If they're watching, three Batmans. Okay. So I work really closely with them. They're really hands-on. Really passionate about the industry. And they're like, they're hands-on with the brands as well.
Okay.
And then another big element of the role is external stakeholders. Okay. So our investors, our debt providers, that's a big part of my role as well.
And when you say investors, debt providers, you like providing reports to them, presentations to them. What are the skills that you need to be able to communicate with them? Because the imposter syndrome in me when I hear investors. I'm like, I can never speak to investors, debt providers. What the hell is this? Like, yeah, what are the kind of conversations, just to get a little bit of an insight?
I mean, honestly, you and me both. Like, when I joined the company, I think it's my first month, and we had, well, at the time, 20 brands. And I knew nothing about any of the brands. And I did that classic thing where I walked into this meeting with our debt provider, month one. And they said, oh, like, welcome to Heroes. I hear you're the new commercial director. Are you going to be leading this meeting? Now, I should have said
no,
because I don't know anything. I've just got here. I was just like, yeah, really excited to be here. And then off I went for an entire hour talking about numbers that honestly I didn't really know the story behind. And I think like the brothers and the CEO at the time was literally messaging me being like, Beth, you don't have to do this. Like, we can step in. And I just couldn't even. So anyway.
So it was scary,
but you just.
You just do. Are you happy that you made that decision and said yes? Or like, to anybody who's potentially, you know, first month in, would you just say no?
Honestly, I think it would have been advisable if I said no, because it really could have backfired and I could have actually like fallen on my face.
Like bad first impressions.
It could have been bad first impressions. Yeah. I think I was quite lucky that as a commercial person, I'd spent the first month being like, I need to know my brands. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care about anything else. This is what I need to know. So I'd at least had prioritized learning the most I could to be in that meeting. So it went okay. And I think the good thing about saying yes was that it was precedent that I ran that meeting every month.
Okay.
And maybe if I hadn't said yes, I might never have ran it. Mm. And now I run it every single month. I'm super comfortable running it. Good relationship with our debt providers. I think it's like a core part of my role.
So on that, I love that, by the way, to anybody who, you know, we hear imposter syndrome thrown around a lot, to anybody who might be suffering from imposter syndrome, what would your advice be to them?
My advice would be, it's okay to feel that way. God, if you speak to any of my friends, they like, I'm constantly talking me down from the shelf.
Mm.
How to get over it. To be honest, I think if I think about some things that my team have said to me, one thing really sticks with me and says, Beth, like, of anything that you are, you're real.
Mm.
And I think I just try and be real. I don't actually try and pretend. I think a lot of advice is like fake it till you make it. I don't actually try and pretend to be anything.
Yeah.
Like, I can come in and be like, guys, got an idea, what do you think? And if they all go, that's rubbish, I'd be like, fair enough. Mm. Probably was. And then we just move on. But like, just keep it real. And then I think you're not trying to put yourself on this pedestal that you can't even reach.
Yeah.
I think so many times in the day I will say to my team, like, obviously I can't do that because I'm not smart enough.
Mm.
Like Bo, someone in my team who's a wizard, can you go and do that for me?
Yeah.
Because I know it would take you 5 minutes, it will take me 5 hours.
Yeah.
But like, I'll have another skill and, you know, I can help him with something else. And it's not really about hierarchy or your role. Just like, be real, say what you don't know.
And leverage the resources you have at your disposal.
Right? Like, yeah. No, I think a lot of the time you can be like, I need to know everything. I need to be able to do everything. Me spending hours and hours and hours of my week learning how to code, for example, is not going to help Heroes, because we have really, really intelligent coders and analysts in our company.
Yeah.
I don't need to be one as well.
I get that. And I think what I would say on that as well, because in my role in customer success, like, you definitely have times of imposter syndrome and not knowing, just not knowing things about the product, about the market, about competitors. I think where I've found the best conversations are when you're just honest.
Yeah.
And I think that there's always something I live by, like, don't try and bluff the customer. Because if you try and bluff the customer, it might work out at that moment in time, but in the long run, it's not going to work out well. So, I think honesty and transparency, because I think to an extent, everybody's in the same boat and everybody knows, we're not like, we don't know everything, right? We're not all Einstein. So there's a lot of grace that can be given if you're just open and honest with people.
Yeah, I think my team always laugh at me. I literally pronounce words wrong all the time. I spell everything wrong, obviously.
Hmm.
So I think they're just a bit like, who's this guy?
No, Beth, I have no doubt that they know that you're a boss. It's so funny. Since you said that at the start, in my head, it says, I'm a boss ass bitch.
Bitch. Okay, I don't go around thinking that, to be clear.
I'm saying this is what's going on in my head. all right, so question I have here, which is quite good. So, yeah, I've got a couple here, actually. Having moved from roles like program manager at Amazon to commercial director at Heroes, what leadership skills have you found most valuable in both a corporate giant and a more specialized venture like Heroes?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. The leadership skills are quite different. I think it's important to explain why. And actually, this is probably a bit of advice that I would give to anybody. There is a really, really big difference to between big corporation and startup. And I think we're definitely in the in this world where like working in a startup is like the fashionable thing to do, right? It's like everyone working in a startup. And I love working in a startup, don't get me wrong. The benefits of working in a startup are awesome because you are really owning so much more of what you do. Like the deliverables are very much yours. You can kind of be like, I actually did this and this is what I delivered. When a big corporation, you probably would do like this amount of like a total project, or you won't even speak to a certain team because they're based in Romania and you never see the end result, basically. So there's a huge benefit there. But then I think with startup, there is a whole another upswing of you are completely accountable and there is no like layers above you where you can be like, oh, well, you know, oops.
The buck lies with you.
Yeah. And that is exciting and that you learn a lot from that, but that can be quite overwhelming. So I would say like in terms of like leadership skills, you have to be way more considered, I would say, in like in my role in Heroes. I have to really think about how everything's working together because I can't assume that anybody else is thinking about that because they're not. Whereas in Amazon, I'd be like in one team of 100,000 teams across the US and everyone was pulling together and everyone was feeding up to one big investment and one big share price.
So on that as well, do you feel like you have to be more conservative as well? Because obviously Amazon is like unlimited funds, right? So yeah, you could be out, it's like happy to fail. They want to take big swings, right?
They do. So the reason I would say I'm not more conservative Heroes is because everything you do in a startup is really a risk. So like everything, you can see the money that you have available to you and you have to put that into different bits of pies and you really aren't, you can do as much work as you want. You're never going to know that's going to pay back. Whereas in Amazon, even if you want to take a risk, they might just say no. Whereas in Heroes, you're more likely to someone to say yes to your risk, which is awesome because then you get to go and do it. But then you're also going to have like full transparency, like everyone asking you, well, how did that go?
Yeah.
Did it work? And you've got to be the one going, God, this needs to work.
Yeah.
And not, it's not like a huge pressure environment. Like it's a very much a supportive environment, but that is the truth of the matter. Whereas Jeff Bezos is not checking if my team was successful in the UK. Let's be honest.
Let's check your Twitter DMs after this. See if it. Beth, I knew all about what you were doing back in the day. No, I'm joking. And talking about leadership, obviously it goes without saying you're a female. When we think about a lot of industries, like I've had a lot of people who've spoken about like diversity, equality, and inclusion. What has your experience being a female leader been like? And that's all the way through, right? Because you mentioned the fact that you were the only person at Sainsbury's who was at the depot as a female all the way up to now, right? Where you're a commercial director at a company led by three brothers. What has your personal experience as a female leader been like?
I think what I'm about to say might be a bit controversial.
Okay.
But I think I've benefited. Okay. I think I've benefited from being a female.
Okay.
And I've thought about this quite a few times. And I think the reason is, rightly or wrongly, well, wrongly, actually, is that people don't feel threatened by me.
Okay.
So if I, so even if I go all the way back to like when I was in logistics depot, I think I was seen as like sweet girl. Mm-hmm. And that worked really well for me because I got to like fly under the radar. I got to do things that I wanted to do. Whereas like my male counterpart who was in the same depot as me on the same grad scheme was kind of like pulled into like all the shift work and all this kind of thing. And I was just kind of like, I'm going to do some projects. And they were like, oh, okay, you go and do some projects. And like, I went to go and learn everything I wanted to go and learn. And that actually worked for me even all the way back then. And I would say even now, like being a boss is not everything that is cut out to be. And there's lots of politics in every role that you're in, every company, be it internal, be it with external parties. And I think actually sometimes you can see clashes, especially when it's a full male room normally. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're the only female, you can kind of actually almost distance yourself from that clash and not get involved. And therefore you don't really have to be in the heat.
Yeah.
So you can use it to your advantage is what I think I'm trying to say.
And what about like as a younger female, work like managing older men? How do you navigate that dynamic?
God, I should ask some of the men. Manage.
Yeah.
Look, I think again it goes back to just being like humble and being real. Like I'm not trying to come in here and be like I know everything and you don't. I'm sure there are times where I've made people feel like I'm patronizing them, or I mean, that is the nature of what's going to, is sometimes how these interactions go, mm-hmm. especially when you need to get someone to do something, mm-hmm. You know, but it's business.
Yeah.
But I think I try and always build a rapport, be like, look, I don't know everything about, let's say your brand, for example. I'm not an expert whatsoever. I'm not even going to pretend that I am. I don't even want to be, really. That's your job. You're amazing at it. I'm not even going to try and do that. What I am good at is being able to, let's say, launch a product in the US. So let me help you do that. You can do all the rest that's right for your brand. So I think like it's just a way of, it's not like a hierarchical piece. It's just you do what you're good at. I'll do what I'm good at. And hopefully we can like achieve
we
it together.
Thrive.
Yeah.
I was gonna say
last thing. I'm like, I'm also not afraid of getting like my hands dirty and like working hard. Mm-hmm. So I think if you come in and you're a bit like delegate, all that task is below me, there's everyone's gonna be like, oh, what are you doing here then? Like, why are you not here to help? Where as like I don't really think that way. Like I'm very happy to just get stuck in and get things done.
I hear that. I love that. And then just like following up on that to any female listeners who are potentially seeking positions of leadership, what would your main piece of advice be to them or main consideration?
What first came to my head is like, be careful what you wish for.
Okay. Wow. That's real. It's real.
I'm real.
Yeah.
And it's not that I don't love my job, to be clear, I do. And I really enjoy being in a position of leadership. It's really, I get to be involved in such important work and really exciting. But I would say that I'm quite lucky in the fact that I have like a good support network around me. I have like other purposes in my life that are not work. Mm-hmm. I'm kept humble. So I think what I'm trying to say is I know what I am and am not willing to sacrifice to succeed at work. Mm-hmm. And I won't ever cross that line.
Okay.
I wouldn't sacrifice my marriage. I wouldn't sacrifice my relationship with God. I wouldn't sacrifice my friendships that I've built. I wouldn't sacrifice my family. And because I know that through and through, then I don't let being in a leadership role or having a big career that I too and Drew really, really enjoy, I don't let that impact the rest of my life.
Nice.
And I think there are people that I have seen and people that I know who haven't had that kind of foundation that then this be careful what you wish for.
Work consumes them. Basically.
Yeah. They get their dream job, but everything else around them crumbles. Mm. And it's a very, very sad thing to see because I don't think you should judge someone's success on what they're achieving at work.
Yeah.
It's not really how I look at it.
Yeah, we've spoken a lot about your role and about obviously being like a female leader. What would you say is the most stressful part of being a commercial director?
I would say the most stressful part is it's a 24-hour operation, 365 days a year.
Ish.
Ish. So like, although there's a weekend, I'm very aware that like our products are selling all around the world and our customers are buying them. And therefore, there's an element of me that's always kind of thinking about what's happening with the numbers. Have we got something out of sale? Has it been blocked on Amazon? Like, what am I coming into on Monday? And although I'm very good at like protecting my time and not working when I don't choose to work, it doesn't mean I don't work weekends.
Yeah.
I do, but I choose to work weekends. Yeah. I would say it's out of choice. Not every weekend, it's when I want to, and there's a piece of work that I want to get done. But I would say that's probably the most stressful element is that, you know, we're all going to go on a Christmas break. There is no real Christmas break to sales.
The break ain't breaking.
No, the break is not breaking at all. Where like other jobs, you can like finish a project, right? And you're like, wow, worked on that project for 6 months. I'm just going to rest for a little bit. And nothing else really big going on. A few meetings here and there. That doesn't really happen in my world.
Okay, I understand that. And I always do this. On the flip side, what would you say the most rewarding aspect of being a commercial director is?
Sales growth.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's exciting. That's what I'm working for, right?
Okay, yeah. Seeing the numbers go up.
That's my job.
That year-on-year growth. So is Black Friday like an exciting time for you?
Yeah, of course.
Look at the way I was. Yeah. Oh my God, did you see that? Yeah, of course. You did the Dasso Raven. Like, you just was like, whoa. I was like, whoa. Okay.
If you cannot do this job, if that does not excite you.
Yeah.
Because that is literally what your every single day is going towards.
Yeah.
Trying to see the numbers go up, be it sales or profit.
Okay.
And if you don't find that exciting, don't do this job.
BFCM, numbers going up.
Yes.
Beth, I'm with you. We've spoken so much about the role. What would you say is a common skill you see amongst other people in like a similar role to yourself or throughout your businesses?
Good question. A lot of my team, when they start and they're new, they ask me like, oh, what does success look like in this role? I would say most commercial roles, the best people that I have in my team are the ones that independently identify an opportunity, raise this opportunity with kind of a business case behind it and say, this is why I think it's important. I've done some analysis. And then they don't stop there. They then go and actually do the thing they said they were going to do. Mm-hmm. And then they loop back with, this is what happened when I did this thing. And then they think about how they expand it across the rest of the company or different countries or different products. And to me, it's actually that whole life cycle is the bit that makes this work.
Okay.
Like find something with that and then come back and go, guys, this is what I did. Like it was awesome. Because then you're sharing that learning. And then that, instead of you just doing it on your own, and it being like good, but like the impact small, you actually could have such a wide impact with this one thing that you did.
So what I've heard there is be proactive.
Yeah.
And then come back with data and be ready to expand on your proactivity.
Yeah.
Man, I hear that, man. I'm even thinking about that for myself. I love that. I suppose this question's kind of linked. What do you think is like the biggest factor that has helped you get to where you've got to?
God.
Okay. Hey, look, that's fair. God, one word answer, we'll take it. Obviously your role is very taxing. You work with, you said, 30 brands. Do you have any productivity hacks?
I'm probably the wrong person to ask. Productivity hacks. I think I am relatively disciplined in only worrying and spending time on things that have the biggest impact. So like, I call them like needle movers.
Mm-hmm.
If the thing that we're working on is not going to change my top line number, sales growth, all about sales, all about the numbers going up, I don't really want to do it.
Okay.
And it, maybe someone says it's the right thing to do. Okay, great. But I'm not going to put team resource towards it because I'm going to say, like, if that isn't moving our numbers, let's not even go down that road. Okay. So I think that is helpful, just focusing on things that are actually going to create change.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, why are you doing it?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Do you enjoy what you do?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm very lucky.
This isn't on my questions, but have you ever thought about, oh, I wonder what life would be like if I was still, if I'd got that training contract?
I think about it all the time. God was working that day when I got all those rejections.
Okay. So
I would be a terrible, terrible solicitor.
Okay.
Terrible. I think like the hierarchy, the rules, the concentration. I've got a lot of friends who are solicitors and the things they work on are just, they're like, in like terms and condition sheets for hours, just like independently. That's not me. Like, I need to work with people. I need to be bouncing off ideas. I need to be doing lots of variety. Juggling loads of things at once is like when I'm working at my best,
mm-hmm.
because I'm just like really fired up by that. And like that industry would have not been good for me. So yeah, I'm really fortunate that I got all those rejections. That's the moral of the story.
You're happy that life took you right when it tried to.
Yeah.
We thank God. I'm switching it up again because I wanted to find the right time to kind of discuss this. Right at the start of the podcast, you were like, you mentioned the fact you're dyslexic.
Yeah.
I think it's good to kind of, you know, talk about these things. Regardless of your dyslexia, you've obviously gotten into the position that you have now.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose my question is to anybody out there who is dyslexic, one, what would your advice be to them? And two, how is it that, yeah, you overcome? I suppose maybe overcome is the wrong word, but how is it you work with dyslexia?
It's a good question. I would say don't try and overcome it because you will actually be like a losing battle. I did try and do that. And it was a disaster.
Hey, did you always know that you were dyslexic, like going into university? Was it diagnosed early?
It wasn't diagnosed early at all.
Okay.
I always, at school, was in like all those spelling booster classes when you're at primary school and was kind of like put into like the special room because I wasn't like, but at then they didn't really diagnose it back then.
Okay.
And then when I was in secondary school, I did get extra, maybe like 10 minutes extra time at GCSE level, but not before that. And then at university, again, nothing. I only got diagnosed in my last year of university when it was too late, which I can tell you now was really stupid.
It really stupid?
To get diagnosed later.
Yeah.
Because I would have got 40 minutes longer than every single one of my exams.
Oh.
And I didn't get it.
Okay, fair.
That was why it was stupid. So get diagnosed early, because it really does help you and you do need the extra time. It isn't because you're lazy. It's because you actually cannot read and digest information as quickly as everybody else.
So that's the definition of...
Well, that's one of the main things.
Okay.
And then you don't take... It doesn't come out as quickly as everybody else. You have to think about everything like a lot more.
Okay.
For your words to make sense.
Understood.
You can probably hear it in this podcast.
No.
When I'm not thinking about what I'm saying, my brain like jumbles up the sentence.
Okay.
And I'll put words in the wrong place. And I write the same. So I will put words and letters in all the wrong places.
And then I suppose, so my question to that is like, when you're talking to employers, your staff, is it just something that you're open with from the jump? Like, hey, by the way, like, how do you approach that for people who are dyslexic in the workplace?
Yeah.
Is it something that you just go, hey guys, I'm dyslexic, so if you see me like jumble words up, you just have to forgive me?
Yeah.
Or do you put in extra effort to, you know, use Grammarly, make sure that you're like rereading everything 5 times to make sure things are in the right order?
Mm-hmm. I do both.
Okay.
So I learned quite late in Amazon that I think there was like a senior leader in Amazon who basically gave feedback to my manager that I wasn't taking care of my work. And that I was, you know, Amazon has very, very high standards, very high standards. So like anything that's like any sentence construction doesn't work, any spelling error, it looks messy. And I've got quite a high bar too. So I got this, but the feedback, I totally understood where it came from. And I hadn't really spoken to a manager about being dyslexic and how much harder I found it. But it's almost irrelevant. Like, it doesn't mean you can now have terrible emails, right? So it's like, great, good to know. My manager was like, good to know, because I will now read, if it's like a really big report or it's going to like a senior leader, I would then send it to her first. Because another thing about dyslexia is that you can't even see your own mistakes most of the time, because your brain reads it correctly. So I could read something honestly 10 times and it would be like, this is perfect.
I think that happens a lot. That happens a lot.
100%. Yeah. I remember once I was writing for the Amazon Fresh Stores, we were writing a sustainability report, and I was like leading the sustainability strategy for our stores in the UK and Europe. So I was writing this, I think it must have been like a 20-page document, and I had written sustainability manager wrong 136 times. I called it sustainability manger.
Wow.
And like, no spell check's going to tell you that, because it's the correct word, but it's not the right word. And how many times I read this report. So my manager was like, really good report, but you have spelled it wrong every single time. And I was like, oh, classic me.
But luckily it's a quick like little spell check.
It was like a little like find and replace, right? But I do this all the time.
Yeah. And I think like the reason I think is key to bring this up, right? Because to your point, because you were able to have the conversation with your manager, they put processes in place. So I think the advice to anybody who might have dyslexia is just make sure that you're communicating this to your colleagues, not so your quality decreases, but just so there's a level of understanding why things might happen in a certain way, is what I'll say.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm glad we covered that. I really wanted to discuss that. We've spoken about the fact that you obviously love what you do. You've mentioned the fact that you work on some weekends. Do you have a good work-life balance?
I think so.
Okay.
And the reason that is because I actually do really enjoy what I do. And I feel like, yes, I'm working for somebody else and I'm providing a service for them. And that's literally what my job is, right? That's why I get paid. But at the same time, there's elements within that job that I feel like I'm doing to work on myself too, and like personal development, that isn't, that I'm getting a lot of benefit from it. Like, it's not just for them, it's for me as well. Like, it's kind of, I feel like it's a bit of a win-win relationship, which I think is an amazing thing to try and strive for in your career. Like, are you getting back as much as you feel like you're giving in? And if that's equal, then everyone's winning. Yeah. Like, if the company's getting what they want and you're learning what you want in your career, great. So I think there are times where I will, for my own benefit, be like, actually, I want this, I want that to be a better piece of work. Like, I finished it on Friday, I've got the meeting first thing Monday. Do you know what? Let me just put 2 hours aside for me to get that to a place where I'm like happy with it, and I'll learn like how to improve it, etc. So I would say yes. And there's no one who, you know, I'm very fortunate that the company's very like output driven. So there's no one saying like, hey, it's 4 p.m. like, why are you off Slack? That's not the culture. Because everyone knows that everyone's working hard. That's just the truth of the matter. So like, that's never a conversation. So I would say it works for me because I get to choose.
You're autonomous with your time.
Correct.
Which is like such a big thing.
You work more because you are autonomous, and like people don't really get this.
Always the way. That leads me nicely into, you know, something everyone wants to know about. Do you feel, number one, fairly compensated for what you do? And are you able to share like a range for what people in the roles that you've held can tend to earn?
Do you want this role or all roles? Because I've done a lot of roles.
Let's go this role. Let's so go commercial, this role. Commercial VP, director, commercial, VP of commercial.
Yeah, that kind of. So you're really in a leadership commercial role. So it is incredibly dependent on what country you're working on and the size of your portfolio that you're working on. Mm-hmm. But so let's say your P&L, so like your profit and loss account. If you're earning, which, you know, our company is 130 million a year, right? So if you're looking after that size versus looking after 1.5 million, you're not getting paid the same.
Okay.
Not even close, right? That's all, let's know that. Okay. Also, if you're owning a 10 million one, you know, so there's a lot of levels to that. And also if you're working in the US, in this role versus the UK, wildly different.
More or less.
Way more in the US, okay. Like all roles, really. Okay. You're probably talking like 2-3x.
Wow.
Yeah, it's insane.
Okay.
But I would say probably as a range in terms of your portfolio and you're looking at in a real leadership role in commercial, you're probably starting anywhere from 80.
Okay.
And then depending on your, you can be going up to, I mean, people who are commercial directors.
The number is endless.
Six figures plus, just lots of them, right?
Okay.
And that's not what I'm on, right? But they're like, you know, millions a year.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. You heard it here first.
Yeah.
That's healthy.
Me one day.
Yeah. Yeah. Receive it. Yeah. Manifest it. How do you unwind?
I'm terrible at unwinding. You know my husband. Yeah. You know this about me. I think I get into a state of productivity, which I really struggle to like get off, which is definitely like my own weakness. I'm just wired to be productive in everything that I'm doing, which doesn't work when you need to unwind, because the whole point of unwinding is not to be productive.
Yeah.
So I try and make unwind time productive, which I can tell you now is stupid. Yeah. So I don't think I'm very good at this advice.
Okay.
But find something in your day that makes you not think about anything else. For me, it's exercise. That's the only thing that when I'm doing it, I'm not thinking, oh, I've got to put the dishwasher on, or oh, I've got to send that email out to the US. Like, that's the only thing. Mm-hmm. But I also can understand anyone who's watching this, exercise is a productive thing to do. It's not really unwinding. But it is. I think a lot of mentally, people do it. I switch off.
Like, I had somebody on the podcast, he cycles, and he was like, he goes on like 100-mile cycles, and he's like, the first 10 minutes, he might think about work, but then the next 2 hours switch of the cycle, off. He just completely just doesn't have a podcast in, doesn't have anything in his ear. He just cycles, and he's just there with his thoughts. And
I think you need that.
Okay, so that makes sense. To anybody looking to get started, I suppose, it'd be more in your sector versus like you wouldn't just go straight into like being a commercial director. What would your advice be to them?
There's so many roles they could get into. Like, it's, I would see it as, honestly, like it's a really exciting space. Like, there's just so much you can do with it. And I would just think about roles and be like, even if you're not sure if that's the role or that's the company, apply, like have the conversation. Does it sound exciting? If I did this role for a year, do I think I'll be better off? And if the answer to that is yes, then like, why not?
Okay.
Especially when you're young. Like I said, the career is 60 years. If you spend 1 year doing something that isn't like for you long term, doesn't matter. It's not going to stop you from being
where you need to be,
where you want to be when you're 60 and retired. Like, it's not ever going to slow you down. It's just not how it works.
Yeah, I always say fail fast.
Right.
Like, the quicker you fail, the quicker you are to like, being on the right path.
And I would just say, think about the skills you're going to learn in that role. So like there's a role in my team, for example, it's called like a brand management role. And the whole point of that role is that you manage an Amazon brand. So you look at that and you go, well, I'm going to learn how to run one of the biggest e-commerce platforms in the world. That's probably going to be a helpful transferable skill. Then I'm going to learn how to run a retail business and own my own P&L. That's probably going to be a helpful, useful skill. So if you start listing out all these skills and you suddenly go, yeah, I'm going to do that job. Mm. Because whatever happens, a lot of that's transferable wherever you go.
Yeah.
So that's how I probably would think about it.
Love it. And then Beth, obviously, you know, I've gotten the sense from this that you're very productive. You love work. Where does Beth see herself in the next 5 and 10 years?
Gosh, slowing down.
I don't even think you believe that.
No, I don't. Honestly, I don't. I say this to my husband all the time. He literally just looks at me like, you're lying to yourself. Yeah. I'm terrible when I'm slow. Mm-hmm. That's actually like, I'm at my worst when I'm not like challenged. So although I think this in my head, the reality is it wouldn't be good for me.
Okay.
Where do I see myself? I mean, hopefully just continuing to do, like, be really fortunate to get some really exciting roles and be involved in new business acquisitions, new chances for growth. This is what excites me, really. Like,
maybe own your own thing.
Maybe.
Be the ultimate boss, the final boss, the end boss.
I don't know about that. You know? It's something that you always think you want to do.
Yeah.
And it has been presented to me in the past as like a genuine option with, you know, maybe someone's left Amazon and said, hey, do you want to come join work, you know, be a co-founder with me, la, la, la. And like, actually the thought hasn't excited me as much. And having worked in a startup and see working with the founders who own this company that I'm in, I do often look at them and think, oh, I don't think I could do what you do. Like, yeah, and it's just not for everybody.
Yeah.
And I think we're in this society where, again, everyone is pushed to be like, be your own boss, be your own boss. And like, definitely be your own boss if you're going to enjoy that.
Yeah.
If you aren't going to enjoy that and you're going to find that really stressful and like too overwhelming, or it's actually not something you want to do, like, don't do that.
This is the reason for this podcast, right? Because everybody's pushed to be their own
boss.
But ultimately, a lot of us are just going to end up working for somebody else. So we might as well find like a job and career that we enjoy and that is going to, you know, afford us, you know, a decent standard of living.
Yeah, you can do your own boss at any time of your life.
Exactly.
You can be one at 60 if you want. So like, don't have to rush and do one at 21.
I'm going to be retired at 60. In
yeah,
Jesus'
you are.
Name.
Amen.
Okay. Beth, thank you so much for this. This has been sick. We've got a quick fire round. Don't say bye just yet.
I was about to say, can I go at the quick fire round? No.
Yeah, here we go. You ready? Work from home or work from an office?
Office.
Money or happiness?
Happiness.
Favorite day of the week?
Sunday.
Oh, I love that. Time in a group or time alone?
Group.
This one isn't on here. Sainsbury's local or Amazon Fresh?
Sainsbury's local.
Okay. Would you rather travel to the past or future?
Oh, God. The future.
Yeah. Favorite book?
The Colour Purple.
Oh, nice. Night out or night in?
In.
Okay.
I'm old now.
Who has it easier, men or women?
Men.
Yeah. Name a book you think everyone should read.
4-Hour Working Week.
Oh, wow. I thought he was going to say the Bible, but look.
Shit off.
No, this joking.
Is the assumption that everyone's read the Bible.
Yeah. Okay, good. And then finally, are you listening to any good podcasts?
Other than this one?
Yeah.
No, I'm not a podcast girl.
Okay, fair. So just what my best friend does. Beth, we do have a closing tradition on this podcast. So, okay. Final thing before we let you go. So, you know, you've obviously had a lot of experiences and knowing everything you know now and everything you've been through, what advice would you give your younger self, your 16-year-old self, and would you still be doing the same thing?
Yeah, I would say don't put so much pressure on yourself to do everything in the shortest period of time possible.
Mm-hmm.
This is definitely a constant thing that I've seen from my friends and myself, to be like, I want to get promoted in the next 6 months. And if I don't, I've failed.
Mm.
And in the meantime, you have a really terrible time. You're stressed over that period. You're devastated when it doesn't happen. And actually, it means nothing if you just waited another 6 months. It means nothing. And you could have actually enjoyed that year instead of really just unnecessarily put pressure on yourself. So I think, like, if you get rejected, it's for a reason. If you need to slow down, it's for a reason. So just strive to be happy and content and strive to enjoy what you do.
Okay. And would you still be doing the same thing, knowing what you know?
I would, yeah.
Okay, sick. Beth, where can people find you? Any socials you want to share?
LinkedIn.
Yeah.
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 Beth Adebayo.
There you go. Fun fact, Beth's surname is my first name. Yeah.
We're not married, just so anyone gets
married to another anybody, just to be clear. But guys, if you've made it to this point of the podcast, thank you so much. You know what you need to do? You got to like, you got to share, you got to comment, you got to, you know, plug it across all your socials. This has been another episode of What My Best Friend Does. If you didn't know, now you know. Over and out.